welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is part two of A Plantation Life Before Emancipation. Chapter 5, The Negro, How He Was Housed, Fed, Clothed, Physicked, and Worked. In this letter, I shall speak not without passing allusions to practices prevailing elsewhere, mainly of the general custom, with regard to the above matters in my own native county, convinced that the representation will be recognised by the well-informed as a fair average picture of the conduct of the entire South. The houses on some plantations were constructed of sawed lumber, furnished by the adjacent water mills, or cut out by the Negro sawers laboriously, and not very accurately with the whipsaw, worked in pen or pit, and making a tolerably fair joint possible. On our plantation they were, for the most part, covered with a weatherboarding of clapboards split along the grain, with what was called a frow, and from short cuts of cypress logs and not admitting of a very close fitting. The houses were never lined within, so that only the thickness of a single board kept out the winter's air and cold. Usually the house had two or more unglazed windows, and a front and a back door, and was warmed by a clay chimney with a wide hearth abundantly supplied with oak and pine. You entered first the common living room. Separated from it and with its door was the family bedroom, and if the children were half grown, you would find frequently one or two shed rooms or lean-tos in the rear, furnishing all proper privacy. The furnishing of the servants' home was primitive. There were a few benches and a rude rocker, all of home manufacture, shelves in the corner containing neatly scrubbed pails and piggins made by the plantation coopers of alternate stripes of redolent white cypress and fragrant red cedar. Bright tins and white and coloured plates, with the never-absent long-necked gourd dipper, and beneath them the ovens, pots and skillets, the simple but most efficient paraphernalia of the mother cook. The bedroom had a few boxes containing the simple finery and Sunday clothes of the family. The weekday garments hung upon a string stretched across the corner. The bedstead consisted of a few boards nailed across a pair of trestles, and covered with the soft black moss so abundantly yielded by the adjacent swamps, and quite a number of good warm blankets in which the sleepers, oblivious to the change of seasons, would wrap themselves up until not a square inch of sable skin was exposed. Their food was mainly maize, which, where a public mill was handy, was ground for them. On my father's place they ground it themselves on the common handmill. Also the sweet potato, abounding in starch, the main nutritious ingredient in all food products, and easily and quickly cooked in the ashes or baked before a fire. The weekly allowance for a hand or a full worker was, I believe, a peck of corn, and 4 quarts additional for every child, and 1/2 bushel of sweet potatoes to each adult, and to each child in the same proportion. This weekly fare the year round was, with us, supplemented in the season when the work was unusually heavy by rations of molasses or bacon or saltfish and an occasional beef. To this, thrifty servants added rice, of which they were as fond as the Chinese, and which they cultivated themselves in patches allotted to them, and with seed and thyme afforded by their masters, and chickens and bacon of their own raising and curing, and fish of their own catching. So abundant were the rations of corn that at the end of a week the careful householder sent quite a bag of it to the store to be exchanged for calico or tobacco. As to their clothing, 2 good strong suits were given every year. In the summer, white Osnabergs, in the winter, a kind of jeans, partly cotton and mostly wool, and stout brogans. The clothes were often cut and made up in the big house by Negro seamstresses. The housewomen were clad in a very neat fabric called linsey-woolsey, and with the houseboys fell heirs to the half-worn garments of the young masters and mistresses. A good warm blanket was given each worker every alternate year, so that a little care accumulated an abundance of warm bed coverings. As for their physiquing, this was largely and not unskillfully done by the planter himself. In each plantation library was a book of medicine. My father's, I remember, was Ewell's Practice, books written without technical phrases, clearly describing in the language of the common people diseases and their remedies. As the maladies of the African, with his simple civilization, were rarely obscure, many planters acquired a very considerable skill in diagnosing and prescribing, and probably killed no more of their patients than the young MD graduate is said to kill, just in getting his hand in. A big jug of castor oil was always on hand, but it had to be kept under lock and key. So fond was the darkie of dosing himself for any and every ailment with that antiquated and heroic remedy. Another thing he had the utmost faith in was the lancet, for according to his simple therapeutics, it let the bad blood out, just as rubbing a sprained ankle with cold water towards the toes would send the inflammation from their tips into nothingness. When a case, however, was too serious or complicated or obscure for the planter's knowledge or skill, or obstinately refused to yield to the few remedies of his materia medica, Tom, or Jerry, was mounted on a swift horse and sent post-haste for the doctor, 5 or 10 miles away. Whenever we met a negro riding furiously, we always divined going for the doctor, and were seldom wrong. He only checked up his foaming steed long enough to confirm our surmise, for it was his peculiar joy to tell the news, especially if bad. The doctor, it must be admitted, had but a poor chance, either to cure or at his leisure to run up a bill, and this practice of only sending for his services in desperate cases depressed patient and doctor and nurses, and contributed sometimes to a fatal result. To send for the doctor was, in plantation belief, to give up the case, and the doctor's patients recovered only by a special miracle, but when they did not, they at least died secundum artem. As for their work, they were never called out in the rain, and open sheds were always provided in distant fields against thunder showers. In some parts of the south they were, with an interval of a noonday rest of several hours, in the field from sun-up to sundown. But in all such instances their food was cooked for them, and they were generously fed upon full rations of bacon. With us the work was, in the main, extremely light. It was the duty of the men to split the pine rails with which the plantation was enclosed, to clear the forest from the new ground prepared for tillage. The women and the thrash gang, i.e. the half-grown boys and girls, made up the fences. The men commonly drove the plough, the women never handled anything heavier than the hoe. In the harvest both used the sickle, the men threshed the rice and trod the cotton foot gin, while to the women was assigned the easier task of sorting the lint of its specks and leaves. Our lands were light and friable and easily worked, and for a large part of spring and summer the hands were allotted task work, and many is the time I have in the spring season seen the industrious labourer shouldering his hoe with the sun high in the sky, ready to work his own allotted patch in the rice field, or to go churning or lounging and gossiping in the village street. Compare the average house of the slave with the one-roomed mud hovel of the Irish tiller in Roman Catholic Ireland, with no privacy by day or night. The suitable and substantial clothing and bed covering supplied the slave with the scanty and sometimes ragged raiment of the poor in our great cities and even labourers in our factories. Their big fires would, ad libitum, with the miserable smouldering embers over which the poor sewing women crouch shivering in northern cities, the excellent nursing and good medical attention given the slave, with the condition of many of the poor workpeople who dare not or will not in their pride call in a physician, for whose services they are unable to pay. Compare the hours of labour in the open air, not pushed to exhaustion and comparatively short, with the long and drastic work of many artisans, against which there is a constant demand for restrictive legislation, And add to this the consideration that if the white master lived in comparative luxury upon the fruit of the labour of his slaves, he had all the care and forethought and responsibility of directing and organising the labour for united efficiency. In a word, that he supplemented the African brawn with Anglo-Saxon brain. And it will be perceived that no labouring population in the world were ever better off than the southern slaves, and that there never was a falser accusation made against the southern planter than this, harped upon by abolitionists of old, and repeated sometimes by northern preachers now, that he kept back the hire of the labourer. The plain truth is just this, that no tillers of the soil in ancient or modern times received such ample compensation for their labours. He was not paid down, it is true, in cash, but he was amply compensated for his toil, in free quarters, free medical attention, free food, free firewood, free support of the sick and infirm, aged and young, and the free supply of that organising faculty which utilised labour and made it more productive and capable of supporting, without the remotest fear of starvation, or even of scarcity, and without appeal to public charity, of entire slave communities, often as large as that of a good-sized village of whites. Chapter 6. The Negro, How He Was Governed. It was not unusual for defenders of slavery to describe the institution as patriarchal. It was undoubtedly such, but with some important modifications. Abraham was a nomad. He had no permanent connection with the soil, nor acquired more than a transient ownership by the digging of wells for his flocks. He had not a foot of it in actual possession, although all Canaan was, by divine gift, his for his posterity. He did not sow and reap as did his son Isaac. He was in no sense amenable to the laws of the land in which he temporarily sojourned with his family and flocks. His household, composed of his wives and servants, born in his house or bought with his money, constituted an independent commonwealth, of which he was the acknowledged sole and sovereign head. His will was law. On the contrary, the planter and his household were a part of the state. His slaves were recognised as in measure the basis of the electoral apportionment. They were, as far as capital offences were concerned, amenable to the laws of the country. If a Negro committed murder, he was, by white and black testimony and the verdict of a white jury, condemned, and by a white judge sentenced, and by a white sheriff hung. But all other offences, such as are now carried by them into a justice's court, were adjudicated by the master, from whose decision there was no appeal. First, the master was the supreme authority on the plantation, in all matters, but those in which human life was involved. Was a servant suspected of or caught thieving or fighting or beating his wife, he was summoned before the master. The witnesses heard, and justice, without appeal to innumerable authorities or the law's delay, swiftly overtook the offender. The invariable penalty would be so many lashes according to the gravity of the offence. Over the house servants, the mistress had coordinate authority. Indeed, the master seldom interfered in the domestic rule, save when called upon to assist. The sons and daughters of the planter also exercised a measure of authority, especially over the younger slaves, although they never, as a rule, were allowed to punish offenders. Next to the planter in authority was the overseer. It was mainly upon large plantations where the master needed aid, or where the plantation was owned by an unprotected female, or where the owner was habitually non-resident, that this important official was brought into requisition. He was usually a small planter, of acknowledged skill and experience and success, and ability to manage Negroes. He usually lived on the place in a house provided for him, getting a small salary and money, but allowed the use of horses, servants, food, and firewood. He was usually a man of family, and not infrequently saved enough to become in turn an owner of slaves and plantation. He exercised, in the master's absence, authority over the slaves, with plenary power to punish offenders against plantation law and neglect of work, and his instrument was the lash. Next to him stood the Negro driver. Dr. C.C. Jones studiously avoided the use of this term, calling that official on his plantations the foreman. But in reality, the term in Southern ears had no more suggestiveness of cruelty to men than the phrase carriage driver has of cruelty to animals. And there was no more abuse of power ordinarily in the one case than in the other. The driver commonly carried what was known as a cotton planter, a short whip with heavy handle and tapering thong, plaited into one piece. It was usually worn around his shoulder and was more a symbol of authority than an instrument of service, a reminder of the penalty of neglect rather than an implement of suffering. Now, in regard to the actual exercise of this power and authority by planter, overseer, and driver, we hesitate not to affirm that it was, in the main, as humanely administered as the imperfection of human nature permitted. As for the lash, it was used rarely upon the bare back, or excessively, and it should be remembered that it is only recently that flogging with the cat-o'-nine-tails has been abolished in the Navy. Although all intelligent slaveholders agree with Dr. Thornwell that all that the owner was entitled to was the reasonable service of the slave and control of time and person only so far as was necessary to secure that end, there were undoubtedly masters who, at least in practice, seemed to assume that they owned their bodies as well as their service. Masters who abused their authority to corrupt. I recall one instance now in the family of a favourite body servant of my father, whose wife belonged to a wicked planter. Although a professor of religion, in which, while only persuasion was used, the planter abused his position, with the consent of parents, to the ruin of a daughter. Their insensibility to the sin and shame was to me the saddest part of the business. Then there were planters who were cruel. I recall in our county only two, the one a southerner by birth. He flogged a slave to death. But the fellow servants of his victim informed on him. The body was exhumed and their statements found correct. And upon their testimony and circumstantial proof, he was, by a jury of indignant planters, sent to the Georgia Penitentiary and inevitably branded as a felon. The other was a northerner, and I remember to have heard the remark frequently made that while there were many honourable exceptions as a general rule, the northerners made the most severest masters. And the explanation given was that they had not grown up with and formed attachments to the Negro, and judged his capacity and energy by a white man's standard. This man was a member of our ancestral church. Actually, he had his cook up before the session for not making the full tail of waffles, as I have heard my father laughingly tell. He was so miserly withal that on more than one occasion he was known to direct a belated traveller to the minister's house as the village hotel, who, after taking his ease at Mine Inn and calling for all he wanted for man and beast, was, upon asking his bill next morning, astounded to find how he had been duped. He was also credited with opening his ditches on Sunday in a wet spell of weather, a thing unheard of in that Sabbath-observing community, and of rationing his servants in part on sour oranges. It was his practice to canter on his horse from slave to slave and whip them in the cotton rows. My father related that he once came unexpectedly upon him, just emerging from the woods, with an armful of young hickories. Unable to hide them, he mumbled out an apology about the aggravating character of Negroes. Well, his people killed him finally, as he deserved to be. Striking him in the head with the eye of a hoe, they saddled his horse and, whipping him, sent him flying through the big gate and across the bridge to the town, and, adroitly bloodying a knot which arose from one of the planks, they said that he had been thrown by his horse upon the bridge and instantly killed. Only a quarrel among them brought the killing to light a year after, when the body was taken up and examined, and the story found correct. Several were convicted and hung, but I doubt not more sympathy was felt for the slave than the master, These were clearly exceptional cases, as rare and no more indicative of general treatment of slaves than the conduct of the father who sat his child upon a red-hot stove to help him to recite the Shorter Catechism is of the Northern Presbyterians' treatment of their children. Humanity to slaves was secured by more than one influence. First, the southern planter was as kind-hearted and naturally philanthropic as any class of men found anywhere. Then, with us, he was usually a college-bred man and of liberal culture. Not a few of them were as noble Christian gentlemen as were ever produced by any civilization. Then there was a powerful public sentiment which ostracized a cruel master. In addition to this, self-interest exercised a powerful influence in restraining from cruel treatment. Injury to the slave was a pecuniary loss. A curious illustration of the potency of this principle came under my observation in our Civil War. Planters who cheerfully surrendered their sons to the army protested against the use of their slaves in the trenches. Then, above all, there was a strong attachment between the master and the servant, the natural result of closest association from childhood, which made cruelty foreign to the very nature of the owner. As for the overseer, instances occur to me where the office was abused in both the directions just indicated, but these again were exceptional. The overseer usually enjoyed the protection of a family, wife and children, throwing around him all the restraints of home life. He did not, perhaps, abuse his authority as a means of corruption any more than the foreman of a factory. Then, if cruel in his treatment, there was always the right of appeal to the owner. Convicted, the overseer received his walking papers, his salary in full, with notice to leave as soon as he could get ready, and with a damaged reputation. As for the Negro driver, much the same line of remark applies to him. He was not sustained in his immorality if he used his power to make life pleasant or the reverse to the women slaves to accomplish his purposes, and if cruel, he was instantly deposed. The driver, the carpenter, the carriage driver, and the house servant constituted the Negro aristocracy. To be cast out of that favoured circle of the upper ten was a disgrace, almost more to be dreaded than death. There was all the dishonour in being broken as a driver, as it was termed, that there is in the army in being reduced to the ranks. It was by no means an unusual transaction, and occurred frequently enough to exercise a wholesome restraint upon the strong passions of the Negro official. In our next we shall treat of the marriage and the family relations of the Negro. Chapter 7. Marriage and Family Relations. A high officer of the Northern Presbyterian Church, Reverend Dr. Allen, Secretary of the Freedmen's Committee, in his quarter century's work among the freedmen, affirms that when his church undertook their evangelization, there was not a legal marriage among them, nor had been for 200 years. A breach of the seventh commandment was no bar to church communion. Their religion was an enthusiasm rather than a principle, the enjoyment of religious worship depending chiefly upon the degree of animal excitement produced. To ignore the fifth, seventh, eighth, and ninth commandments was not at all inconsistent with their idea of the religion of Jesus. A slander containing in it a measure of truth is at once the most offensive and dangerous kind. By it, truth is dishonoured, an error given what it does not in itself possess, vitality. Undoubtedly, there were not in slavery times marriages legalised by such formal documents as licences issued by competent courts, and the master had, under the law, the power of separating by sale or removal husband and wife, as this was a right supposed, whether correctly or incorrectly, to be incident to ownership. In too many instances, the marriage relation was thus broken up, not often voluntarily, but frequently providentially, by the death or bankruptcy of the master. But I have known instances in which the greatest sacrifices were made by humane masters to keep husband and wife together. Let me give an example or two occurring under my own observation. Harry Stevens was a very valuable slave, for he was a carpenter, pursuing his trade in Liberty and the adjoining counties, and paying his master a sure monthly and handsome wage, while laying by something for himself and his family. His wife and family were freed by their master and sent to Liberia. My father, in order not to separate the family, sacrificed half his value, or about $750 or $900, and the balance was made up by contributions of neighbouring slaveholders, and Harry became a citizen of the Free African Republic. I have known planters also to hire hands they did not need in order to keep husband and wife together. A service of this kind, which I had the opportunity of rendering to a favourite servant, was last summer gratefully recalled to my mind by his now aged widow. The impression, sought apparently to be made by the statement upon which we are animadverting, is that the marriage relation among the slaves was very loose and far from sacred. On the contrary, in our county not only was it gladly celebrated by the white pastor or coloured minister, but where they were preferred, by Negro watchmen, who were appointed by the church as a kind of under-shepherd, and duly authorised to solemnise marriages. We hesitate not to say that the marriages thus contracted were, by the slaves themselves and their masters, generally regarded quite as sacred as marriages solemnised with legal licence of the courts, and the obligations as commonly observed as among the same class anywhere. There were as many faithful husbands and wives, we believe, as are to be found among the working white population in any land. The weddings of the housegirls were usually celebrated in the master's mansion, the bride decked for the altar by the skilful needles and elegant taste of the young mistresses of the household. On a large sugar plantation in Louisiana, owned by a distinguished bishop of the Episcopal Church who fell near Marietta, Georgia, fighting for the South, all the marriages were celebrated in the great house. The broad hall was decorated for the occasion with evergreens and flowers and illuminated with many lights. The honour coveted by the white children and given as the reward of good behaviour was to hold aloft the silver candlesticks as the good bishop read the marriage service. If the couple had seriously misbehaved, they were compelled by the master to atone for it by marriage, and in that case there was no display, but the guilty pair were summoned from the field, and in their working clothes in the study, without flowers or candles, were made husband and wife. On large sugar and cotton plantations, marriages were not permitted with persons off the place. Even in such cases, the choice was as wide as often falls for the lot of young white people living in a village community. In our county, they were permitted to marry wherever they chose, and their almost universal choice was of husbands and wives at a distance from 1 to 15 miles. Saturday nights, the roads were, in consequence, filled with men on their way to Wife House, each pedestrian or horseman bearing in a bag his soiled clothes and all the good things he could collect during the week for the delectation of his household. Our cook, Ma'am Willoughby, used laughingly to say that before greeting Dublin, her husband, she always looked to see what he had brought in his bag for the family. This practice, of course, was not very good for family discipline, as the father was away from his child all the week, as indeed often occurs with white toilers everywhere, and they were left entirely to the management of the mother. Sometimes it made trouble on the plantation when the labourer came late to his Monday's task. It was perhaps due to this fact that news in our county spread like a prairie fire. The negro on his way to his family was as good as what was called in the war the grapevine telegraph. The negro almost invariably married, and married young, for there were no costly preparations to be made, no ambition of bride for a palace to be consulted. A house was speedily erected by the plantation carpenter for the newly married pair. As for food, raiment, and medicine, that was the master's concern. I remember now but 2 negro bachelors, and I believe they only remained in single blessedness for a season. Of course, we would not hold them up as model parents. This they were not, and only too much disposed to resort to blows and slaps in family matters. But they were neither better nor worse, perhaps, than the working class of any country. As for the strange intimation that violations of the 7th commandment were no bars to church communion in southern churches, It is simply, so far as my acquaintance with the subject warrants positiveness of statement, notoriously and injuriously false. Two facts will be enough to prove this averment. In our county, and I suppose it was largely true elsewhere, the most frequent cause of suspension from church fellowship and even excommunication was offences against identically this commandment. And then further, while here and there, especially in the cities where churches composed entirely of Negroes, members and officers, such exclusive organisations were as a matter of policy and safety discouraged generally at the South. As a rule, the churches of the South had a mixed membership, white and black, and if they had a Negro preacher, he was usually under the control of the white pastor. To insinuate, then, that violations of the Seventh Commandment were in the South, in slavery times, no bars to church communion, is to charge the white Christians of that section with a criminal complicity, which only a complete array of well-attested facts can redeem the author of the libel from the accusation of a wilful bearing of false witness against his neighbour. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 3 of Plantation Life Before Emancipation.